Stories, Threads, and Magic from the Life of Dennis C. Merritt, Part 4. Adventure, Adventure, 1970s to 2010s. This story is a thread, starting with Willie and Patty Crowther's cave maps from the 1970s, which led to the first adventure computer game and to my career building AI applications in the 1990s and 2000s. Cave Exploration, The Reality, late 1960s to early 1970s. I was an active rock climber in the late 1960s and 1970s and spent a lot of time at the Gunks, a popular upstate New York climbing area. Also active at the time were the Crowthers, Willie and Patty. Willie was a more experienced climber than I and took me up my first 5'8 at the Gunks, a grade that was considered hard at the time. It was a big boost for me and gave me the confidence to continue to grow as a climber. But that's not this story. However, it is another debt that I owe to Willie. This story is about caving. The Crowthers were also cavers and were particularly active in the caves under the Flint Ridge in Kentucky. Mammoth Cave and Flint Cave were both there and were both long, complex caves with hundreds of miles of networked rooms and passages. They were ranked as the second and third longest caves in the world. Might there be an unexplored passage that connected them? If so, whoever discovered it would have discovered the world's single longest, most complex cave. The Crowthers were hooked. Since they were both talented computer scientists with access to the machines of the day, this was before personal computers, they used their skills to create detailed computer maps to model the cave systems. With these, they were able to not only document the cave systems, but to see where they were closest and a connection most likely to be found. It worked. In 1972, Patty discovered and crawled through a narrow passage and connected the caves. This made her a very famous caver indeed. Cave Exploration, The Game, around 1976. Meanwhile, back at the Gunks, Patty and Willie ran into marital difficulties and eventually wound up getting a divorce. This meant that, when Willie had visitation with their two kids, he needed to think of fun things to do. He decided to take the computer models of the caves and turn them into a game, where the kids could explore the cave systems going from room to room with wondrous descriptions of all there was to see. Now, this was the 1970s, and there were no personal computers or graphics screens. It was all done with the player giving commands in English and the computer responding with text descriptions of the environments. For example, as you entered one of the rooms, you got this message. You are in a magnificent cavern with a rushing stream, which cascades over a sparkling waterfall into a roaring whirlpool, which disappears through a hole in the floor. Passages exit to the south and the west. The player might then type, go south or go west, and then be given another message describing where that led. The game included accurate descriptions of actual rooms and passages of the Flint Ridge cave system. It was quite large and complex, as was the real cave system. Playing was not a simple afternoon's exploration. Adventure, The Game, 1976. Willie shared the game with Don Woods, who was big into the Lord of the Rings books at the time. Willie's version had some puzzles and whimsy, like the classic bird and snake puzzle, but Don thought it could use more. And so he added all sorts of stuff to the game. The cave became full of, well, adventure, such as a fire-breathing dragon, maddening mazes of twisty passages, axe-throwing dwarves. These were central to clever puzzles, and the key was often the things lying about. You could take them, and they would be with you as you move through the game. For example, in one room, you would see this description. There is a small wicker cage discarded nearby. You could then type, take cage, and it would be with you and useful for catching the bird you needed when you got into the room where a huge green fierce snake bars the way. Spoiler alert, the bird can drive the snake away. And there were prizes about, gold and other gems, and they were worth points, and the game had a goal to collect all the points scattered about and protected by puzzles. This was the very first interactive exploration computer game. They called it Adventure. You might notice that this is the same basic architecture of a host of computer games that follow. This particular genre of text-based adventure games was called interactive fiction, but it's the same basic idea used in the Mario Brothers games and Zelda, and still today in Fortnite and the like. That basic architecture of a player exploring a computer-simulated environment, collecting the things that are there, using them to solve puzzles, and reach some goal is no different today than it was when Willy and Don released that first adventure into the wilds of academic computer centers. Adventure Infects Draper Labs, 1977. Willie worked at Lincoln Labs, which is one of the MIT-associated research labs around Boston, and I worked at the MIT Instrumentation Lab, later called Draper Labs, also one of those research labs. It's no surprise that one day, one of those large tapes you see spinning in old movies about computers showed up in our computer group and was quickly installed on the mainframe computer for all to play. At the time, most jobs were still run using decks of punched card input and printed green bar fan-folded output. But there were also terminals scattered about that allowed interactive use of that one main computer. It was on these that one could play Adventure. Many of us did. My Addiction. Adventure was the first totally addictive computer game, and I was one of the earliest addicts. I had to keep exploring, just a little further, trying one more way to slay the dragon, escape the maze, or find the plover's egg. I was fascinated with it, both as a player and as a programmer. Willy had modeled a whole world in software and opened it to exploration. There had never been anything like it before. Playing at work wasn't enough. The lab also had portable terminals that you could bring home and connect to the mainframe computer using a modem and a phone. So I did. And just as Willie had played the game with his kids, I would spend evenings and weekends playing the game with my son. We spent hours playing, puzzling, thinking, and drawing and expanding our map of the cave. We must have had a dozen sheets of paper taped together by the time we were done. Then something scary happened at work. It was time for my performance review, and all I'd been doing at work was playing Adventure. I went into my boss's office. He opened a large folder of green bar computer output, scanned through it, and found my name. He said, "You've been spending a lot of time on the computer, and even working evenings and weekends. That's what I like to see in my programmers." He gave me the maximum raise. My first personal computer, 1984. Whit found all the points, explored the entire cave, and moved on to other things. My career was changing as well, and with an idea that I might one day have my own software company, I had moved from aerospace to commercial software. I was working for Cullinet, the first software company listed on the New York Stock Exchange, and the first to advertise in a Super Bowl. Around 1984, when they decided to expand their traditional mainframe computer software into the emerging IBM desktop personal computer, PC, market. As part of that effort, they made PCs available to the employees for their home use. I jumped at the opportunity. My first thought was Adventure, the software which had so fascinated me 7 years earlier. Now, having my own machine, I was ready to start writing code and creating my own software worlds. There were challenges. Given what we have today, it might be hard to imagine how unimaginative software was back then. It was called data processing, and that's exactly what it was. Programs were procedures that processed data. A program's execution was carefully choreographed using procedural programming languages. This was fine for calculating payroll or plotting a trajectory to the moon, but not for creating an artificial world like Adventures. The problem was the programmer didn't control the game. The player did. Who knew where the player might go, what the player might do? This meant the software had to store the knowledge of the game separate from the control part that monitored the player. That controlled component would then query the knowledge at each move, taking just what was needed at the time. This was the challenge, to implement that encyclopedia of the game's world using a procedural programming language ill-suited to the task. It required the development of higher-level tools that could be used to specify the rooms, connections, and puzzles, as well as the changing state of the game, all in some non-procedural way. I immediately set to work using the C programming language, and I was designing the ways to represent this and that when... The magic of prologue. This next bit should really be in the magic part of the book. I never went to lectures on anything, really, let alone computers. I wasn't a member of the Boston Computer Society, BCS, and yet someone asked me if I wanted to go to the BCS meeting that night and hear a lecture on this new programming language, Prolog. I said okay. Prolog was not like any of the normal step-by-step programming language. It was an entirely different way to write software, based on logic. Its name came from pro, P-R-O, gramming in L-O-G, logic. The programmer didn't specify sequences of instructions, but rather made logical assertions, in no particular order, which could then be queried. Based on the situation, Prolog would determine which logical assertions applied. It was a very, very different way of programming, and required a different way of thinking about software. But do you see? It had everything in it that I was in the process of trying to create. Logical assertions could be used to represent everything, and Prolog would, well, almost automatically pick the right ones for any given situation. I was blown away. I immediately got hold of an implementation of Prolog and started using it to develop my own game. Nani Search. I quickly had everything I needed to create an adventure game. One problem. I really didn't have the imagination to create a fantasy environment. I had all the software tools and had laid out the framework for a game, but no game idea. So rather than try to create one from my imagination, I decided to write a simple one based on a real-life quest. That was my young daughter's hunt for her lost security blanket, her Nani. I called it Nani Search. You want to see how perfect Prolog is for an exploration game? Here's some of the actual Prolog code I typed to create Nani Search. These statements model some of the rooms, connections, and food lying about. Room, office. Room, kitchen. Room, cellar. Door, kitchen, cellar. Door, kitchen, office. Location, apple kitchen. Location, broccoli kitchen. Location, cookie office. Just like that. You type them in just as I have just said them. Here are some facts I wrote about the food in the game world and rules about what happens when you try to eat various things. Tastes good, apple. Tastes good, cookie. Tastes yucky, broccoli. Eat X. Tastes good X, right? That X tasted good. Eat X. Tastes yucky X. Right, 3-year-olds don't eat X. And how do you ask Prolog about eating something? Well, just like this. Question mark, eat broccoli? 3-year-olds don't eat broccoli. Question mark, eat cookie? That cookie was good. How easy can it get? Want to add fanciful descriptions, more things, more actions, more complexity, whimsy? It's easy. Just type in the logic using correct Prolog syntax and it's ready to play. Prolog, right out of the box, had the expressiveness to model a game environment and a search engine that understood how to use it. It's how you programmed in Prolog. Yet many programmers just didn't get it, and there was really only one rather academic text on Prolog, so I decided to write a book. Adventure in Prolog. NaniSearch was perfect for teaching Prolog, so I wrote a tutorial using it to showcase everything you could do with Prolog. I called it Adventure in Prolog. It went through many iterations and was, and still is, used all over the world for learning Prolog. The book brought me a bit of fame in the relatively small world of logic programming. Artificial intelligence. While I was playing games, more serious academic types were working in the emerging field of artificial intelligence, AI. Yes, the promise of AI was big in the 1980s. Unlike today's machine learning AI, the AI of the day required programmers to hand code the knowledge in the system, usually in the form of rules. It was called knowledge engineering. One class of AI application was called expert systems because they attempted to replicate the knowledge, the rules of experts for problems such as diagnosis, configuration, or identification. Why were these systems called AI? Because, as mentioned above, computer programs of the day ran in a linear fashion. But that's not how the human mind works. Instead, we have all this knowledge in our heads and, depending on what's going on at the time, call up just what's needed. That's what was so new and exciting about both Adventure, the game, and AI. They work more like the human mind. The knowledge just sits there, waiting for the search engine of the game or expert system to ask for some tidbit of wisdom. Prolog was perfect for this, which meant me to write another book, also still used today, called Expert Systems in Prolog. AMSI, Inc., 1990 to 2010. The books led to consulting work and an opportunity to acquire a version of Prolog and start our own Prolog company, AMSI, Inc. Thanks to my two books, we got a fair amount of business building expert systems and other knowledge-based systems. Ross Perot's company, EDS, contacted me because they were using Prolog to write the flight planning system for Orbitz, a Travelocity competitor. They had used Adventure in Prolog to learn and wanted me to teach and consult. Imagine, if you use Orbitz, that software was written by someone who learned by exploring my daughter's world, searching for her nanny. They sold the software to a company in China, which got me teaching there and led to an adventure exploring the wild, non-tourist parts of the Great Wall. The U.S. government contacted us to develop an online, in 1995, breast cancer decision support system to help women navigate through the options of that disease. We got a Smithsonian Award for that, and the Washington Post said it was the only application worth anything on the internet at the time. Among other fun Prolog projects, we were the first to schedule Division I college basketball, a tricky problem, provide complete pediatric vaccination analysis, and unscramble a Rubik's Cube. All of these were based on the same basic Prolog programming techniques I developed playing with that first adventure game. Retirement, 2015. The work didn't make us rich, but it was fun and did well enough that we didn't have to get real jobs. Had it not been for Willie's creative invention of adventure, my professional life might have been very different and probably nowhere near as much fun. Thank you, Willie. Juan's Soldiers, 2006, Asheville. My grandson Juan was visiting, and maybe about 7 or 8 at the time. We had bags of those small plastic soldiers, and he had been playing with them for a while, and had laid out some large military formation. He came to me and said, "Grandpa, I need more guys." My first instinct was to say, "Juan, you've got a zillion guys. You don't need any more." Instead, I decided to ask him why he thought he needed more. It turned out he wasn't just messing about. He had a full military campaign in mind and proceeded to explain to me in great detail the forces he had aligned, how they interacted, the battles that were to ensue, and the different divisions of the scene, and, most important, the lack of forces needed for a key part of the campaign. We went out and got more guys. What would Diego do? 2004, Norfolk. I had just spent a week in Norfolk helping Michael with the boys while Anna was visiting her sister in Bolivia. Michael had an interesting book on birth order, which I read bits and pieces of, which basically indicated that later-borns tend to rebel. I was reading the boys a nighttime story, the old Uncle Remus stories that you can't get anymore because they're racist, except I'm not sure about that, and Michael had found a copy at a used bookstore on the web. Being firstborn, I had a goal of finishing the story. Diego kept interrupting, wanting to do this or that. I wanted to push on with the story, and Juan did too. The firstborns pursuing a goal, the latterborn advocating anarchy, chaos, and fun. The boys were both in Juan's bed. Post-story, rather than going to sleep, they were fooling around, but we'd already had to deal with tired kids who had been up too late the night before, so I went up to quiet them. I told them they had a choice, either be quiet, or I would separate them into different rooms. Diego wasn't buying it. Juan, the firstborn, understood and explained the rules to Diego. I made it clear those were the choices for Diego. Diego simply responded, "But I just want to play." He rejected the options I gave him. He rejected the authority. He rejected the rules of behavior. He simply had a different way of looking at things and wanted to follow his heart. Writing well, 1970s to right now. A personal journey from reading about database to writing about jazz on a baritone ukulele. If you were involved with computers in the 1970s, you would be impressed with the name James Martin. He was big then, but fame is so fleeting, even programmers today don't know of him. However, then he used to get $20,000 a day consulting for large companies on software strategies, and was a prolific writer on all things computer. He supposedly made more money selling textbooks than any other textbook author. I was the kid good at math and who hated English. This led to a programming career in my 20s, working in aerospace. When I was around 30, I decided to leave aerospace and work in the commercial sector for a company selling mainframe database software, late 1970s. I didn't know anything about database technology, so I bought James Martin's book on database, a large book. I was ready for a slog, but instead, it was like reading a best-selling novel. Database knowledge just seemed to osmose into my brain. I was amazed. How did he do that? That book got me interested in the challenge of writing about technical things. I saw a similarity between trying to logically structure software code to solve a problem and trying to logically structure sentences and paragraphs to explain a topic. I started to dabble in articles for trade magazines and the like, all about a software niche, Prolog, I was doing as a hobby. By the time I got to age 40, it was time for a midlife crisis. I had abandoned the commercial software companies and decided to make it on my own. It wasn't going well. I was almost out of money and ready to crawl back to the commercial world when my son got rear-ended in my car. Nobody was hurt. It was surgically precise damage that caused the insurance company to write the car off as totaled and send me a check, but left the car still usable after banging out the back. I had money to live on for one more month. Then, just as that money was running out, came the too coincidental to be a coincident part. A fellow I'd known back in my aerospace days, who I hadn't been in touch with for at least 10 years, noticed I was doing some writing. He called me up and asked if I wanted to work for James Martin. It turns out James Martin had spun off a bunch of other writing products and needed writers for them. There I was then, doing contract work for the writer who inspired me to start writing in the first place. I was writing in-depth product reviews for the James Martin Report and ghostwriting his magazine column in Computer World. It was all about the illustrations. He told me that there was a direct correlation between the number of diagrams in a textbook and the sales of that book. It wasn't just that he had illustrations. It was that they were how the book was written. I've always been fascinated by how writers' creative styles affect their work. Like Woodhouse used to make three storylines on pieces of paper tacked around the walls of his cabin, and then look for ways to have them intersect. And if you read his book, well, yes, that's exactly what happens. Elmore Leonard came up with characters first, and then put them in situations to see what they'd do. This instead of having a plot. And in his books, the characters are memorable, but you never remember the plots. James Martin had a bunch of folding tables in a big room in his large house in Vermont. He had bought it from Larry Bird's Celtic teammate, Kevin McHale, who had designed it for a tall person, as James Martin was. He drew diagrams, charts, pictures on pieces of paper, and laid them out and organized them on these tables. If anything wasn't clear, he'd add more pictures. I'll bet the large, spread-out physical workspace let him work with the big picture a lot more easily than someone sitting in front of a computer screen. I bet that explains Woodhouse's ability as well. Total digression. These are thoughts just popping into my head, not part of what I was trying to say, but Woodhouse has been called the best writer of English language fiction, and James Martin has been called the best writer, he's English as well, of English language textbooks, and both used large-scale spaces to lay out their works before setting pen to paper. Anyway, then Lillian, his red-haired girlfriend who used to be married to someone who worked for the Shah of Iran and was kicked out in the revolution, would computerize his drawings, and then he would write the words that glued it all together. I went back and looked at some of his books. There was rarely a page without some chart or diagram on it. When he told us how he wanted the articles in the report written, he had a series of basic diagrams that he wanted us to fill in for the particular technology we were covering. These diagrams had differing relationships of visual elements that would illustrate the layers and connections between elements of a technology. And the structure. He also had an overview architecture that we followed that solved the problem of how to talk about interconnected bits of technology and drill down on one bit without fully explaining the other. He added two steps to the classic tell them what you're going to tell them, tell them what you told them structure. The technology document sections were 1. Abstract, a paragraph. 2. Executive overview, a one-page discussion of the technology. 3. Overview, 3 to 5 pages describing all the components of the system and how they related. And only then, 4, a 30 to 50 page detailed dive into the technology, including examples of use worked out. And finally, 5, a summary. That detailed overview made it possible to write the deeper details referencing bits of the technology that had not yet been covered in depth. Did that make sense? So if A is related to B, then because the relationship is laid out in the beginning, the in-depth analysis of A can refer to B before B has been described in detail. And of course, there were diagrams that had A and B visually related. My ukulele book. At around 70, retired mostly from software and trying to learn about music, I discovered the baritone ukulele and started playing with jazz chords. There isn't really much on jazz for that instrument, and nobody clearly illustrated the connection between the theory of jazz chords and the geometric puzzle of mapping them to the fretboard. Just the sort of thing my computer science brain enjoyed, so I decided to write a book, Jazz Chords for Baritone Ukulele. The book has lots of diagrams that tell the story, and mostly they came first, just as for James Martin. There's a page from the book in the book that illustrates the beautiful cascading chords and harmony of Fly Me to the Moon. I did care about the words as well and went over them many times. At a parent-teacher function, my son's English teacher once noted that there's no such thing as good writing, only good rewriting. Gold Brahmin, 2005, Texas. My professional career was built around a niche programming language called Prolog that was very good for certain sorts of applications. Ross Perot's company, EDS, hired me a number of times to teach classes on Prolog, which they were using to write the flight searching software for orbits. One time I wound up teaching the class in a small Holiday Inn Express, almost an hour's drive outside of Houston, Texas. Why there? Well, that's a story as well. EDS wanted the course to be taught near Miami, where the work was being done, but a hurricane was threatening, and at the last minute, they decided to move the course to their Houston offices. But there was a problem. Hurricane season is also World Series season. And Houston, for the first time, had made it to the World Series. There wasn't an available hotel anywhere near or near the city. While it was a perfectly fine low-cost hotel where we were, the other guests had a different backstory. They were families actually living there. They were people from New Orleans who had been displaced by Hurricane Katrina. So there we were, discussing logic programming in a cheap hotel meeting room way out on the Texas plains, amongst bored and curious children at some strange nexus of global forces, a current hurricane, a past hurricane, and the World Series. For the class, EDS wanted me to teach 15 or so international contractors they had hired to do the work. Most of the students were from Brazil and were a raucous bunch. They took great pleasure in English words that somehow sounded like off-color things in Portuguese. Seafood was, for some reason, very funny to them. Also in the class was one quiet young man from India. He told me he was a gold Brahmin, the top of the Indian caste system. This is the caste of spiritual leaders, among other things. How interesting culture is, how what's important in one is meaningless in another. Anyway, I had given a programming challenge to the class and promised a prize to whoever solved it first. Well, that young man from India got it first. I took a styrofoam coffee cup and used a whiteboard marker to write Prolog Trophy on it. To me, while there was humor in it, I actually meant it as a token honoring his accomplishment. As I gave it to him, I told him it was special. He looked up at me and said, "I know." I cherish the small connections like that one, a moment of understanding. I always wondered how long he kept the cup. I like to imagine it sat on his desk for a number of years into his promising programming career. Flying International, 1980, Washington, D.C. I got a pilot's license a while back and decided to use it to fly myself and a co-worker from Boston to a conference in Washington, D.C. That meant landing at Washington's National Airport, which then, as now, had a reputation for being a very busy and complex airport. Let me tell you about my skill as a pilot. I was pretty good at takeoffs and landings and could handle crosswinds and put the plane down where I wanted. But I didn't have much experience navigating in controlled airspace with changing radio frequencies, towers, controls, headings to fly, etc., etc. So there we were, in a small plane, flying international, the busiest airport I'd ever flown into, and requiring strict compliance with Air Traffic Control, ATC, whose job is to ensure the safe passage of all planes in and about our capital and the airport. As we entered the airspace, I radioed ATC as required. They asked what my heading direction was. I told them, I got it wrong. They had me on their radar and immediately saw my error and deduced I was a total novice that have to walk all the way in. They were incredibly professional, giving me headings to fly and altitudes to fly at, directing me in through the complexity of that airspace, avoiding flying over places like the White House and the Pentagon, as well as staying clear of other planes and taking me in closer and closer to the airport itself. We were within sight of the runway and about to get in line for our final approach to landing. ATC was with us all the way. They said, "Do you see that 737 in front of you?" Now, let me tell you about ATC letting you know about traffic. Usually they say there's a plane at, say, 11 o'clock, and you look and strain, and way off in the distance is a tiny dot, which is the plane they're telling you about. Not this time. That 737 took up at least a third of my windscreen as it crossed in front of us on its final approach to the runway. I said, "Yes," and they said, "Follow it in." Then they added, "And don't slow down, there's another one right behind you." So I'm screaming into the runway, way faster than normal for my small plane, and it's a long runway, and the taxiway I'm supposed to turn onto is quite a ways further down, so I didn't land the plane in taxi like I was taught. I was thinking of that 737 behind me, and I kept flying 10 feet off the runway to just before my turn, put the plane down, and got the hell out of the way. Phew! Those ATC folks were amazing. They took us right in through all that traffic, through all those restricted airspaces, and landed us right in between the heavies while keeping everything going safe and smooth. Hats off to ATC, with a little kudo to me for getting off the runway so fast.